Most of us have heard the adage that anti-Jew hate is the oldest form of hate in the world. And if you haven't heard that, hi, welcome to Being Jewish. We have seen the cyclical emergence and re-emergence of hate against Jews all over the world, century after century, for literally thousands of years. But a core feature of anti-Jewish bigotry is that it shapeshifts. In each time and place where this hatred emerges, it does so in new packaging, deftly tailored to most effectively weaponize that specific society's fear and weaknesses against the Jewish people. The current strain of the anti-Jewish bigotry virus has a number of strategies and costumes it employs, but today I'd like to single out one: inversion. Taking something connected to Jews, twisting it all backwards, and using it against us. This anti-Jew inversion comes in four parts. Allow me to offer a simple example. Imagine a kid, we'll call him Cody, is standing next to his brother, who we'll call Peter, and Peter is holding a baseball bat. Cody grabs Peter's bat, hits Peter with it, then cries, "Mom, Peter hit me." Did you catch all four parts? Part one, ownership. The bat is Peter's. It is his to hold, his to use, his to define. Part two, weaponization. Not only is the bat Peter's, but now his own bat has been used against him to cause him harm. Part three, false blame. Peter is blamed for hitting Cody, something that factually did not occur. And part four, because it's kind of just straight up villainy, I call the dagger. Not only has Peter been blamed for harm he did not cause, but the blame is coming from the person who actually victimized Peter in the way for which Peter is now being blamed. Ownership, weaponization, false blame, the dagger. So now let's look at a few of the most common examples of anti-Jew inversion, shall we? First up, Jews are white. Not only are Jews their own distinct ethnicity that precedes and exceeds any idea of American racial construct, but even if you bought that framework, at least half of the world's Jews are black or brown. We're talking millions of people, including the majority of all Jews in the Jewish homeland, being erased. So let's break that down into the four parts. Ownership. Jewish identity is just that, our identity. No one gets to define it for us or take it from us. Weaponization. Today's elite society, being white is synonymous with being privileged or oppressive, both of which are bad. False blame. If Jews are white, then they are the evil villains oppressing the rest of society. But again, not only are Jews not white, but aside from a few golden decades here in America, we've always been seen as less than white or other. And this is certainly true again today. Visibly Jewish people are seen foremost as Jews, regardless of their skin color. I mean, ask Jewish kids on college campuses if they feel white. And then, of course, the dagger. Many of the folks perpetrating this inversion are themselves white. They are the ones actually persecuting an ethnic minority in the name of their own white guilt. I mean, that is twisted. Another one we hear a lot, Jews are colonizers. This notion inverts the entire factual history of the Jewish people. Ownership. We were a persecuted nation in exile who returned to our homeland. You cannot colonize the place you are from. Weaponization. As with white, a colonizing imperialist is the most evil thing you can be in today's society, despite the fact that, you know, most of us come from countries that were created via colonization and imperialism. False blame. Jews haven't colonized anybody. First of all, half the world's Jews don't even live in the land folks claim they've colonized. So to say Jews are colonizers is just a bigoted conflation. And second, Jews are indigenous to the land and have been living in it continuously for thousands of years. If Israel is a colonizer, why are 20% of Israelis Arab Muslims with freedom of religion and public signage in Arabic in addition to Hebrew and English? Finally, the dagger. Israel has itself been colonized and conquered by many different civilizations over thousands of years, including certain populations of Arabs who now claim to have been colonized by Israel. Twisted. Let's apply these principles to another outrageous inversion. Israel is an apartheid state. Again, outsiders feel they have free rein to dictate to Israel what it is in the most condescending, overconfident, inaccurate, and oversimplified of terms. The apartheid system in South Africa, where you had a white minority ruling over a black majority under a separate system of laws, was terrible and globally condemned. So if you're looking to demonize somebody, it's apartheid all the way. As for false blame, all Israeli citizens, Jewish or not, enjoy completely equal rights under the law. There are Arabs in every level of society and civil service, from the Supreme Court to the army to the Knesset. Now, the West Bank, which is not part of the State of Israel, has its own issues, of course, that deserve to be fairly investigated. But the specifics and context are highly unique to that situation, one that deserves to be examined on its own merits, not just be lazily labeled as apartheid for shortcut demonization. And as for the dagger, basically every other part of the Middle East, including Gaza, to even step foot in there as a Jew is a death sentence. And yet you're going to say Jews are the ones with different rules for different fools? Fatima, please. Can't forget about ethnic cleansing, that old chestnut. Not only has the Palestinian population grown tenfold since Israel's establishment, but Jews have themselves been ethnically cleansed by Muslims and Arabs repeatedly from nearly every country in the Middle East and North Africa. Next, I want to mention the word genocide, though it could be its own monologue entirely and probably will be at some point. But it's important to include here because this one hurts so much and cuts so deep into a wound that is still raw and fresh. So, yalla, ownership. The word genocide itself was literally invented by a Jew to describe the systematic extermination of 6 million Jews during the Holocaust. It is our word. Weaponization. There could be no greater crime against humanity than seeking to wipe out a people based solely on its identity. False blame. There are dozens of facts I could point to that illustrate how Israel is not committing any kind of genocide and never has, but for now, I'll just use this one. In the Holocaust, 66% of Europe's Jews were murdered. In the Rwandan genocide, 70% of the Tutsi population was slaughtered. In Cambodia, 25% of the population was systematically eliminated. In Gaza this year, during a defensive war Israel did not want, that number is 2%. And this according to Hamas's own count, which we know also includes terrorists and natural deaths as well as civilians. 2%. Call it a tragedy. Call it an outrage. Call it whatever you feel it should be called, but don't call it a genocide. Why? The dagger. It is Jews who were the victims of the worst genocide in human history and not that long ago. And it is Hamas who tried to indiscriminately butcher as many Israelis as they could on October 7th, including survivors of the Holocaust. And they have sworn to continue this attempted genocide again and again until they finish the job. And the last inversion, at least of this monologue, is for me the most frustrating. The world's use of the phrase, never again. Never again is our term. Our pledge that rose with our people from the ashes of the Holocaust. It is our ethos, our anthem, our cry of resistance. Its appropriation by other groups and its weaponization against us is a cruelty of the highest order. By co-opting this phrase, the implication is that Jews, who suffered the worst genocide imaginable, are now perpetrators of the same. Not only is this horrendously false, but it is terribly hurtful. Then there's the updated version. Never again means never again for anyone. Says who? Who says that's what it means? Because we, the Jews who invented the slogan, did not say that. We meant it for us. And look, obviously it's not that I take umbrage with protecting people from genocide. Of course not. I take issue with anti-Israel folks appropriating our slogan for their own designs and palisplaining to us what our words mean. And then even worse, weaponizing the words against their actual intent, which is the promise of the Jewish people to be masters of their own fate. The Israeli response to October 7th and to the genocidal aims of Iran and its proxies is precisely what never again looks like. Jews taking their safety into their own hands, whether the world likes it or not, because usually they don't. We have got to denormalize this crap, point out how bigoted and harmful it is, and create a social cost for its use. To those who have employed anti-Jew inversion to demonize our people, I say never again. And in fact, in this case, never again means never again for anyone. This is the 8th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. That's Today, I'm coming to you from the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, my old college stomping grounds. And as part of being a college kid in Philly, I learned the names of all the suburbs around the city, including Bucks County, which was also the name of a short-lived coffee shop on campus. My guest today hails from Bucks County, which he calls one of the most divided counties in the country. So it tracks that he has devoted his career to depolarizing politics through his online newsletter, Tangle, which provides thoughts from the left, the right, and his own take on a single topic each day. Tangle has over 135,000 subscribers, myself among them, and you might think that's his crowning achievement, but he's also a national champion in competitive ultimate frisbee, so, you know, it's a toss-up. Please welcome journalist, entrepreneur, and one-time yeshiva boy, Isaac Saul.
Thanks for having me, Jonah. Glad to be here.
So when I say earliest Keystone Jewish memories, like what image pops into your mind?
Oh, man. JCC, Ewing Township, New Jersey, you know, being a three-year-old running around playing soccer in the gym and basketball. And then definitely, you know, snickering and whispering and misbehaving in the back of synagogue with my family for sure at the Har Sinai Temple in Trenton, New Jersey. So those are my earliest Jewish memories, probably along with the beautiful smell of my grandmother's brisket, you know, that barbecue brisket, nothing better than that good old Jewish grandmother brisket.
I love that.
Wafting from the kitchen and then, you know, fighting my brothers to get there for the first bite. I think those are some of my earliest Keystone Jewish memories.
I love those. So specific. It's great. So you like played at the JCC, you went to synagogue. Did you go to Jewish school or summer camp? Or?
Yeah, I did, like, you know, Tuesday school, Sunday school. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of American Jews, I mean, I was raised Reform, mm-hmm. pretty low key Jewish upbringing. And remember quite vividly after I was bar mitzvahed, I was 13, 14, telling my parents that I was an atheist and I wasn't going to go to synagogue because that was like the cool radical thing to do in the early 2000s when you were a teenager. And really between the ages of 13 and 18, had very little connection or contact with the Jewish world. I mean, culturally, I was still in it and, you know, Hanukkah and Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah and the high holidays and stuff, my family would observe and go to synagogue. But I was sort of in those rebel years where I, you know, I'd been forced to go to Tuesday school, forced to go to Sunday school,
it's
forced
the
to be bar mitzvah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I rebelled too in like middle school. I was like, this sucks. Yeah. Stop making me pray all the time.
Yeah. I think I'm probably more observant and more tied into the Jewish community now than I've ever been. I went to the University of Pittsburgh, and I think it was the second week of being on campus as a college freshman that I was walking through the quad and one of the campus rabbis just, you know, pointed me out. Hey, are you Jewish? I'm like, yeah. How'd you know? There's just everybody kind of has their Judar when you've been in the tribe for a while. And mm-hmm. he invited me to Shabbat dinner at his house and, you know, broke college freshman away from home for the first time. Been 2 weeks since I had a home cooked meal, free dinner. I'm way in. Yeah. You'd say less, you know, I'm coming. And it was beautiful. And he was an Orthodox rabbi and he just made it a really warm, fun experience. And I basically went every Friday for all 4 years of college. And over that experience became really connected to the experience of doing Shabbat dinner. And then went to Israel on birthright. And then after I graduated college, I ended up going and living in Israel for a bit. And I think all of that kind of just snowballed into being a little bit more observant, caring a little bit more about the religious side, thinking more critically about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And now today, you know, I say the Shema every morning. I have Shabbat dinners, host Shabbat dinners at my house with my wife. And try and plug in with the different Jewish communities, depending on where we're living, which has been a really fulfilling experience for me.
Right on. I keep just hearing so many parallels with you to me. Like there was a rabbi in college who invited me to his house for Shabbat, who I'm still like in touch with.
Yeah.
And I say Shema to my son every night. So we got a lot of the same ideas. Yeah. And I saw you wrote your unique spin on Shabbat observance is no social media and no news over Shabbat for 24 hours. I love that.
Yeah.
And what does that say to you about like the individuality of being Jewish?
What I've sort of come to is, you know, it's my relationship with God that matters. It doesn't really matter what other people think about it or how they view it. And I have to develop that kind of on my own in private. And for me, you know, I know what makes it easier for me to connect in the way that I'm supposed to connect on a holiday like Shabbat, and that's unplugging from the news, because that's mm-hmm. my dominant thing that sure. happens throughout life. And I also know that, like, you know, I connect a lot with some of the sacrifice of certain observances, like fasting or, you know, eating kosher, whatever. So on Shabbat, I try and be like as observant of a Jew as I can be. You know, I might like sneak a piece of bacon on Sunday morning, but on Saturday morning, no way.
That's cool.
You know, and like I do. So I try and plug in that way too. And it helps me. It helps me connect. It keeps me grounded. I think it's like a really, it's a powerful tradition for me personally. And the unplugging from the news stuff just related to my work is such a relief. It makes me look forward to sundown at Friday night, you know?
Yeah.
It really does give me that kind of anticipation that I feel like I'm supposed to have for Shabbat, where it's like, I want it to come, I welcome it. And it's a relief, honestly, when I get there.
I love that. It's like yeah. every guest talks yeah. about how Shabbat's like the greatest thing and most meaningful thing.
Yeah.
So we're just, you know, we're trying to spread Shabbat love everywhere.
Yeah.
So as you just mentioned, you studied in Israel at a yeshiva, right? What was that like?
And I was there for about 6 or 7 months. It was a Balshivi yeshiva. So for people who grew up secular and are sort of considering converting to be more religious. So very specifically designed for Jews with my background.
That's
called,
interesting.
Yeah, it was called Or Sameach in East Jerusalem, actually. So a place that, especially right now, is really interesting and at the center of a lot of Israeli conflict, because mm-hmm. For those not familiar, it's like a very diverse part of Jerusalem. A lot of Muslims, a lot of Jews, a lot of Arabs, lots of different kind of faith leanings and layers of different Judaism that exist there. And it's one of the really core melting pots and a mm-hmm. place where there's a lot of friction. And I think that was really interesting for me. Personally, it was the most intellectually stimulating time of my life.
Wow.
Because all my fundamental worldviews were being challenged as somebody who was, you know, culturally Jewish, but not religiously Jewish. And a lot of questions that I was asked about why I believe certain things, I didn't really have great answers for. Mm. And I realized that my worldview is pretty half-baked and that I just had kind of adopted the worldview of a lot of the people and a lot of the Jews that I lived around. And being challenged in certain ways made me think more critically about why I believe certain things and why I didn't. And I found it just tremendous fun.
Everyone in life should face a moment where they have to question their held beliefs, where, I never thought about where that came from or why I actually believe that.
And yeah.
It's great that you had that opportunity. You got to get out of your comfort zone to get it.
Definitely. And it's a good way to do it. If you ever want to get out of your comfort zone, go to yeshiva in Jerusalem for 6 months and it'll do the trick, I'm sure.
And like, if you could distill your experience in East Jerusalem down to like, what was like a big takeaway from your time there that surprised you?
I would say that the people who fundamentally disagree about what happened over the last 3,000 years in a place like Jerusalem are very capable of living side by side in harmony and peace, and with those, you know, contradictions and challenges and disagreements perfectly present and on the surface. And I saw it.
It can be done.
It can be done, yeah.
Now, moving into journalism, how would you describe the state of journalism in America today?
Journalism is broken in a lot of really fundamental ways. I think we live in an information ecosystem that is pretty corrupted. I log on to Twitter or Instagram and I see a bunch of news, quote unquote, right, that is pretty much nonsense. And I open up, you know, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or Fox News, and I see slightly more reliable information that's been edited and fact-checked, but is often presented in a way that's clearly trying to tell a specific story, which I don't think is the job of journalists.
Yeah.
So I see an industry that is definitely in need of some reform and some help and some introspection. I think the industry is going through that right now. I think we're living through it. And, you know, I'm trying to play my role in producing something that's a little bit more big tent and reliable and, you know, North Star of transparency and honesty and balance. And I think we're doing that, but it's really not easy. I mean, you realize when you do the work that the truth is very subjective.
Was identifying this, you know, brokenness of the system the impetus to begin Tangle, or did it come from somewhere else?
Yeah. I mean, my, you know, I have a pretty classic kind of startup entrepreneurial story, which is I wanted a product and I went looking for it and it didn't exist. So I tried to build it. I mean, the story for me was, I'm a politics journalist by trade. That's my background. Writing and reporting are the things that I tend to be pretty good at. And I would hear something happen in the news, a proposal maybe comes up, say Trump wants to build a border wall. And I want to know, what's the pro argument for this border wall and what's the against argument for this border wall?
Yes.
And who are the people making the best arguments for and against? And I want to just go to one place and read it for 10 minutes, 15 minutes and figure it out.
Yep.
And my experience was, okay, I'd read about the story in the Associated Press or Reuters, then I'd read the New York Times coverage, then the Wall Street Journal coverage, then I'd watch some Fox News, then maybe I go listen to the Pod Save America guys, then I go on YouTube and check out my favorite political pundit, and I do 10 hours of this. Yeah. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, now I feel like I have a good understanding of the best arguments for and against Trump's border wall. Why couldn't I just go find that all in one place? Like, why isn't there a news organization putting all those things in one place? And I didn't really see it being done. And the places I saw it being done, I thought were doing it pretty poorly. And so I created this product that was basically founded on that idea.
So anybody who's been following me for any length of time would not be surprised to hear, like, this is right up my alley.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan. But I hadn't heard about Tangle until our mutual acquaintance, Adam Grant, hooked us up for this interview. Who are you trying to reach? And have you been successful in reaching those people?
The North Star for me is I want to bring conservatives and liberals and everybody in the middle under one roof. One of the biggest issues that we have in media and in journalism today is people are just operating on different set of facts or different set of narratives, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, Fox News watchers tend to not read the New York Times,
right,
and vice versa. That strikes me as a massive problem. We don't have a shared reality that we can agree on, even a foundational reality. And so the conversations become basically impossible. So what I'm doing would not be a success in my view if we weren't bringing people under one roof who disagree with each other, the audience. Mm-hmm. And so the biggest pride point that I have is that about a third of our audience self-identifies as liberal, about a third self-identifies as conservative, and a third says that they're independent or they don't view themselves as, you know, associated with any political ideology. And that's an audience now that's, you know, over 150,000 people on the newsletter, a YouTube channel, podcast, whatever, and they're all coming together. They're interacting with each other in the comments. They're, you know, talking to each other when we do live streams. They're doing all these things where they get to see and experience each other together. I would say the other element of it is that I really want to provide representation. So if you're a conservative Trump MAGA voter and you read our newsletter and you don't see your worldview represented somewhere in the newsletter, then we're failing. Mm. If you're diehard Bernie, progressive bro, whatever, and you read our newsletter and you don't see that leftist opinion that you think is part of the conversation represented somewhere in the newsletter, then we're failing. We can't possibly cover 100% of all the views that are out there.
Right.
But I want to get that 90%.
How do you draw the line between what's a valid opinion to feature versus what might be just harmful? Like, is there an extreme that's too extreme to be legit, or in an impartial newsletter, is it all on the table?
Yeah. So this is the biggest challenge of our work. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, one of the things that informs my view on this is I think the way a lot of other media organizations have failed trying to do this is they don't fundamentally represent kind of the new Trump right that exists. So there's magazines like The Week out there where they...
I was going to ask you about The Week, because I've subscribed to The Week for years.
Great magazine.
Sort of
I read the same thing
that you're doing.
Yeah, and I love it. It's a great magazine. I'm a subscriber. I read it. I recommend other people subscribe to it. I will criticize it now by just saying that I think like the conservative views that are represented in a magazine like The Week are traditional establishment Republican views,
right,
almost always.
You get a lot of like David French in there.
Exactly, which like is a small sliver of what the actual right is in America today. So I think a lot of people fail in that regard. And I think actually similarly, kind of the reflection of that is that the sort of leftist, far left progressive view is often also underrepresented. So I try to not be the arbiter of what's an acceptable opinion or not. And that's a really hard part of my job, because sometimes we publish stuff that I find really fundamentally offensive. Where we draw the line is, you know, real, true facts or something that can be backed up with a cogent argument. I mean, this is the thing that's really difficult about my job is I might read something that I find really offensive, but if I can see the person's logic, they show their work and there's an actual argument there, then I'll publish it. Mm-hmm. And we piss a lot of people off doing that, but that's part of the work. We have to accept the fact that, you know, a lot of people are not going to like the things that they find in our newsletter. Mm. It's really hard. I know that's a little bit of a squishy answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense. It's probably a case by case kind of thing.
And you can't draw hard lines right. Because the truth kind of moves and the story moves, you know, like I'll give a really quick example and then I'll stop talking. But the quick one is like, you know, we had a really big debate early on in COVID about whether it came from a lab or not.
Right.
And early days of COVID, it was a quote unquote conspiracy, the idea that coronavirus leaked from a lab. And early on in Tangle, we represented that view because a lot of people were saying back then, and we didn't frame it as a conspiracy theory. We said, some people are arguing this, they have scientific backgrounds, here's what they're saying. And a lot of people were really pissed that we did that. Said that we were elevating, platforming conspiracies, whatever. 3 years later, it looks like it's a pretty legit kind of, you know, both sides have a very strong argument to make their case.
Right.
And it's been a much more legitimized by mainstream science that maybe it's possible it came from a lab. So that's why we treat it that way, is because the truth kind of moves sometimes. And what's a conspiracy, you know, 3 years ago might not be one today. And that's why it's important to allow people to kind of have the debate in the open.
Yeah. I find it interesting that people coming to your newsletter would be upset by certain viewpoints. It's like, this is what you're coming to get. So you if you don't want them all, go read something else.
You know, I've been doing this for over 5 years now. I feel more encouraged about the kind of psyche of the country and the state of polarization than I ever have after doing this work for 5 years, because I don't think it's that people aren't capable. I don't think it's that people don't want this kind of news or want to be exposed to opinions they don't like. I think in their normal day-to-day, it just doesn't happen very often and they're not good at it. And it's a muscle they have to learn to flex. And I think they can learn to do it. I learned to do it from doing the work, but it's not easy. It takes a lot.
I think that's a great way to frame it for people. So here's a specific thing that you covered of the claims that the 2020 election was stolen. You wrote, "We have to accept the fact that ignoring those views or pretending that there is zero validity to them or that they are totally not worth engaging is not a productive way to get closer to the quote unquote truth." Now, what I think you meant is that refusing to acknowledge one side of an argument, even if just to debunk it, doesn't really help anybody. Is that the right read?
70% of conservatives in our country believe that the 2020 election was somehow fishy, stolen, not quite right. That's the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. I disagree with those conservatives. I agree with them about a lot of other stuff. I don't agree with them about that. But the way to get through to them is to not just tell them that, you know, some democracy group looked at the election and determined that it wasn't stolen and you're an idiot if you believe that. That's not an effective way to communicate with somebody. So what I do is I take the claims seriously. I look into them with an open mind and I acknowledge the fact that election fraud does happen. Voter fraud does happen. These are things that are rare, but they occur in the country. They occur in every election. We know that people get caught, people get arrested, people go to court. And so it's okay to say those things happen. And also the idea that, you know, Democrats organized this plot where thousands of people in all the swing states were stuffing ballots into mailboxes didn't actually change the election and wasn't a real thing. You can hold both those things at once. And the people who need to hear you will hear you a lot more easily if you acknowledge some of the stuff that they want you to acknowledge, that like elections could be more secure. We could improve the system we have, all that kind of stuff.
100%. So I've seen a lot of this kind of like defensiveness with the presidential election, where I'll raise some legitimate point about either candidate and I just get sort of like a knee-jerk defensive response that doesn't actually speak to any part of the concern, as you just sort of outlined. Does that sound familiar to you in regards to this election?
Yeah. I would say we're living in a time where people are really emotionally tied to the outcome of national politics and national elections like this, which in some regards, I think it's great. People are dialed in. You know, we had, I think in 2020, 63% of Americans voted in the election. It was one of the biggest turnouts we've ever had. That's good. I want people to participate. Mm-hmm. I want them to care. I want them to be engaged. I think we could do a much better job of kind of hearing each other. And one of the core things that I think is driving sort of what you just described, the knee-jerk reactions, the emotional attachment people have to certain candidates, whether it's hating them or loving them, is that we really fundamentally don't understand the quote unquote other side. So, you know, the perception gap is kind of the academic term for it, but the basic fundamentals of it are, if you ask a Democrat how, what percentage of Republicans think that immigration is bad for the country, their estimate of that percentage is wildly off on average. They think that 80% of Republicans feel that way when really 40% of them do.
Interesting.
If you ask Republicans, you know, what percentage of Democrats think police are fundamentally bad people, they'll say 90% of them think that when it's 20%.
Right.
There is a huge, massive ocean between the reality of what these sides view and what their kind of political opponents think they view, what they hold. So because that's the case, when somebody hears that, you know, Donald Trump did X, Y, or Z, they view whatever the bad extreme thing Trump might have done as representative of Republicans as a whole, and it makes them hate half the country, which I don't think is very good.
Yeah.
But it's kind of the world that we're operating in right now.
Okay, so speaking of the election, this episode is going to air on Election Day, on November 5th. You just released your predictions for what's going to happen in this election. I read that. You believe Harris is going to pick up North Carolina and this state, Pennsylvania, but ultimately she's going to lose the election to Trump. How did it feel to analyze the data and come to that conclusion?
This is a coin flip election. I mean, it really is. It's razor thin and it's super close. And I think anything that happens in the next 2 weeks as we record this could change the outcome of the race. I was a little shocked to get there, not because Trump is, in my view, is a little bit at the advantage right now and is going to win, but because the idea that Kamala Harris could win Pennsylvania and North Carolina and lose the election bucks most sort of mainstream understanding of how this race will go. But when you take all the states individually, as I did, and you just look at the fundamentals on the ground, the polling, the funding, the, you know, Democratic and Republican politicians who are in different races, whether it's gubernatorial races or Senate races or House races, it's just where I landed. And, you know, living in Pennsylvania, I look around and I see Harris running a really good ground game here. I mean, she's in the state a lot. They have a popular governor here, Governor Josh Shapiro. The sign wars are pretty even out in counties like Bucks County, which is not good for the Trump side, I would say. Typically, you know, the Trump right kind of dominates the sign wars and a lot of the on the ground stuff and these weird little quirky things we all watch. And she just has momentum, I think, in the state. And Pennsylvania is a state that tends to be pretty kind of purple and moderate in a lot of the places that matter. And I think Trump's turned off a lot of moderate voters here. But then, you know, the idea that she's going to win Pennsylvania, North Carolina and lose Wisconsin and Michigan, you have to have an explanation for that divergence. You know, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, they typically all go together and they in most elections, they kind of swing the same way. But the truth is, we've gotten some really good reporting from, you know, Democratic insiders who are on the ground running campaigns in states like Wisconsin and Michigan. They're very worried about what they're seeing. They have bad internal polling. The ground game is a mess. The funding isn't what they want it to be. And I think to me, that's going to matter in a race where there's, you know, 10 or 20,000 voters that are probably going to decide the outcome, especially in a state like Michigan, where, you know, we have the protest movement around the Israel-Palestine conflict and a lot of Arab American voters are saying they're going to sit out. If 20 or 30,000 of them actually follow through and do that, that could decide the election.
Yeah, that was an excellent response from the journalistic point of view. What about personally? What did it feel like saying, like, I think Trump's going to win this thing?
For me personally, one of the things that I've really struggled with covering Trump is that he did something after the 2020 election that is just like an indelible mark on his record forever, which is he denied the results and he oversaw the only non-peaceful transfer of power in US history.
Yeah.
I think those things will be the lead on him when the history books are written about him in 50 or 100 years.
Yeah.
And I think they should be. And a lot of my readers and supporters and, you know, Trump supporters who follow my work, they hate that I talk and frame the issue that way because he did things during his presidency that were good, that I think were good, that they think were good.
Sure.
And I understand why they don't like my framing there, but my sensibilities, that's something that I just have a really hard time forgiving. So the idea that he's going to come back into office makes me very nervous because I think he was incredibly divisive as a president. I think he tore the country apart in a lot of ways with his actions and his words. And I lived through that. You know, my friend groups that are very politically eclectic, I felt that. I felt the divide. I felt the way it was so hard for people to talk to each other. And I worry about what happens if he gets reelected, because I think a lot of people are going to basically lose their minds about it. Not me personally, yeah. but a lot of Democrats and liberals, I think, are going to be kind of driven into a really, really, really difficult, dark mindset where they're very upset and feel very disconnected from the country. And that's going to be a really hard thing to work through. Mm. So yeah, a lot of it makes me nervous. Mm. But I think on the whole, my one thing I'll say is, you know, we can handle it as a country. I think we are more together. Our institutions are more stable and we're more ready to navigate, you know, another 4 years of maybe a divisive presidency than a lot of people give us credit for.
So Trump and his MAGA colleagues have actually done pretty poorly as a political movement in a lot of elections. They've lost a lot more than they've won. What do you think has changed so much that now they're going to win the Senate and they're going to win the White House?
The best case against Trump winning this election is pretty much what you just said. I mean, they lost in 2018. They got wiped out in midterms. 2019 special elections, they basically lost all the competitive ones. 2020, Joe Biden wins. He wins the popular vote by a pretty healthy margin. And, you know, they lose the House of the Senate. 2022, they're supposed to have this big red wave. It doesn't actually materialize. Right. Democrats do much better in that election than people think. Basically, in order to say, okay, all of a sudden this losing streak is going to be undone, you have to have something that sort of balances out things like, you know, Roe v. Wade falling, which I think has motivated a lot of Democratic voters.
For sure.
To me, it's the inflation story. I mean, I think it's the economy stupid is a famous political quote for a reason. I think you look at how people feel, not just about the economy today, but what they think about the future of the economy. And they're really nervous and they feel really pessimistic. And that's a really bad thing for the sitting president. Mm. We also have a dynamic that we've been observing, especially in the last 20 or 30 years of US politics, where the electorate is what we call thermostatic. So we change based on who's in the White House, what the temperature is. So, you know, that's why midterms are typically bad for the people who hold the White House, because the electorate is thermostatic. They want change. So it's like a very American thing. The moderates in the middle, they see what's happening, they're upset. And so they decide to punch a vote for somebody else. So that has been the dynamic that we've been living in for some time now. And I think Harris and Biden have not had a successful enough presidency to sort of overcome the fact that the voters who are really going to matter, the kind of moderate swing voters, are thermostatic and they're going to vote against what we currently have. Also, just for what it's worth, you know, a lot of what Biden has done and a lot of what Harris has done, especially on foreign policy, has, I think, self-evidently failed. Russia is in Ukraine right now. Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. There's an incredible amount of instability in Eastern Europe. The war in Gaza has been going on for a year. No ceasefire deal. The things that Biden has been pushing for. The relationship with Israel is totally frayed. This stuff does not give an aura of stability and competence.
Sure.
And I think that's going to hurt them for a lot of people who vote on those kinds of issues.
All right. So you mentioned the war in Gaza. So I'm going to get into the Israel stuff of it all. You are an avowed Zionist with, as you say, a deep love for Israel, but you also hesitate to call yourself pro-Israel. I believe that distinction you're making is that you believe the Jewish state should exist, but under its current government, some of its policies, you feel like you have to refrain from saying you're fully pro-Israel. Is that accurate?
Yes, I fundamentally believe in Israel's right to exist. I think that there's a future for Israel that I could and would be really proud of and really supportive of. I think the current incarnation of the government and the conflict that I'm watching unfold, I'm deeply uncomfortable with and I struggle with on a personal note. And it's really hard to feel that way because I do love Israel and I do think, you know, the Jewish people have a legitimate claim to the land, at least in the sense that we came from there and we belong there in a lot of ways. And I wish we could all do a better job sharing it, not just the Jews, but the Arabs and the Christians and the Muslims and everybody who's there. But, you know, we're living in a really, really difficult state of conflict and there are a lot of really hard decisions I'm glad I don't have to make, but I'll certainly sit here and criticize some of them from afar.
So on October 10th of last year, you wrote, "You cannot keep 2 million people living in the conditions people in Gaza are living in and expect peace. Violent rebellion is guaranteed." So what I draw from this are two implications. One, that you believe the attack of October 7th was motivated by something Israel's doing other than the ideology to kill all Israelis and take the land. And two, that Israel bears the brunt of responsibility for conditions in Gaza, rather than blaming Egypt or the Palestinian leadership who've received billions of dollars and not spent it on the territory of the people. Are those assertions accurate?
I love that you picked that because it's was by far the most controversial two sentences that I wrote in that like 5,000 word piece. And it was the one I got the most feedback to. And so I think the one I've had kind of the most practice defending. Mm. I would say this. I think you can hold that Israel has some responsibility for the conditions in Gaza. You can hold that a group like Hamas gets support in Gaza because of the conditions the people who aren't Hamas live in. And you can also hold that Hamas is responsible for the actions that they took, knowing that they were inviting the war, the kind of war that they got. I mean, one of my big objections to what Netanyahu and the war cabinet have done in the last year is that, in my view, Hamas is getting exactly what they want. Maybe not so much recently.
Yeah.
Yahya Sinwar dead. You know, a lot of leaders have been killed. Yeah. We're a year out, though.
Right.
I would say the first few months of the conflict, Hamas got exactly what they wanted,
right,
which I think is a damning indictment of Hamas and also a little bit of an indictment of Israel in the sense that it does not strike me as particularly complicated that Hamas was inviting this response, that they knew this response would come, mm-hmm, and that they thought they could turn the tide of the kind of global opinion on the conflict in the way they did, which, by the way, they've done quite successfully,
yeah,
which worries me a great deal. So, man, like, Gaza is not... If I could take back something I wrote then, and you actually didn't quote it, I think it came in the next sentence. Mm-hmm. You know, I used some of the kind of activist language saying Gaza is a, you know, open air prison,
right,
which I regret writing that because what it's done, I think, or that language sort of distracts from the fact that there actually was quite a good deal in Gaza of, you know, restaurants, schools, hospitals, these things that were valuable that the society had built despite Hamas, despite embargoes, despite, you know, how difficult it is to bring things in and out of the strip. They had prevailed in some ways. The people who wanted to build a better future for Gaza had done that. And in the war, a lot of that stuff has been destroyed. I mean, 60% of the infrastructure in Gaza is gone, basically. And, you know, by, in a weird way, by framing the difficulties that they face in such extreme terms, it almost undermines and takes away from the value of what a lot of them have lost. And I think I regret that because it both speaks to what was possible there, and it also was sort of exaggerating in some ways the actions of Israel and, you know, demonizing Israel in a way that wasn't necessary and made it difficult for a lot of my kind of pro-Israeli readers to hear me. And so my job every day is holding these really difficult contradictory views, yeah, that have to coexist. And I think it's really, really possible that you can view, as I do, leaders of Hamas, people like Yahya Sinwar, as, you know, evil, really, in fundamental ways, and, you know, have your mind blown when you see, you know, I had the experience, Yahya Sinwar gets killed. I go online, I see leftists like celebrating the iconic last moments of his, right, life with one arm. And then you go read the New York Times or you read some Arabic news where people are reporting on it, where they're interviewing Gazans who are celebrating the fact he's dead.
Right.
And I'm like, there are leftists in America idolizing this guy while actual Palestinians in Gaza are happy he's dead because they understand what he's done.
Yeah.
They know what he's done. And so I believe all that. I see all that. It looks very clear to me. And at the same time, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu bet on Hamas.
Right.
He funded them. He allowed, mm-hmm, that. He thought that they were going to be this reformist group. And he holds responsibility for that. And so, you know, it's a really hard thing to hold at the same time.
Yeah.
But I try and do it because I think, you know, it sort of, it diminishes the conflict. It makes it too black and white to do anything else, in my opinion.
Something else you wrote: they have already stopped the flow of water, electricity, and food to 2 million people and killed dozens of civilians in their retaliatory bombings. We should never accept this. without addressing the fact that Gaza gets very little of its water and electricity from Israel to begin with and should probably nothing, is that not just a description of war?
I think what I saw in the very early days was the reality that in order to conduct the war, there was going to be 2 million people who were going to experience incredible suffering. All of a sudden, any notion of peace, any opportunity to sort of reconcile is just push back generations. And what we got was worse than that thing that I feared, I think, which has been a year of war and tens of thousands of civilians dead. The hostages still not home. You know, I mean, good God, and in a different world where Hamas experienced the first week of the Israeli bombardment and decided they wanted nothing to do with this and let the hostages go. I mean, how different does our world look if that happened? You know, like, you know, it makes me so hopeless about the future. I mean, I talked about the hope I had after living in East Jerusalem, and like so much of that has been sapped because I understand why people on different sides of the conflict are so far apart now today. And I really struggle to imagine a world where they take steps back toward each other in the near future, which sucks.
Yeah. It's a grim picture.
One of my readers said to me one time, he said, "Your pacifism and your Zionism always fight. And in the end, you always seem to pick your pacifism." And he might be right. I mean, it's not just for what Palestinians experienced in Gaza, but, you know, Israelis are being fired on by Iran and the Houthi rebels came into it and Hezbollah came into it. And, you know, on October 8th, all that stuff was unknown at the time. And a lot of the worst case stuff has now happened.
You, throughout this conflict, have called a lot for a ceasefire. And you even had an article, "The Zionist Case for a Ceasefire." How do you feel they should achieve a ceasefire in a way that doesn't just kick the can down the road to start this thing all over again in another year?
I could frame, I think, what's happening now as sort of history repeating itself, right? Israel has fought ground wars in Lebanon. They've gone into Lebanon before in response to attacks or threats. They've gone into Gaza. They've been in Gaza and withdrawn and gone back and withdrawn. We've experienced a lot of the things that we're experiencing right now. I mean, the sort of exceptional stuff is, you know, Iran firing directly on Israel. That's never happened before in history. But a lot of the stuff is sort of these cyclical things that we've seen before. And so what I argue a lot in the, in, you know, my quote unquote Zionist case for a ceasefire is that I don't think Israel is much safer today than it was on October 8th. I think it's self-evident by the fact that, you know, Israelis are sheltering in Tel Aviv as rockets rain down from the skies. Yeah. I think it's self-evident from the fact that more Israeli soldiers have died in the last year than, you know, in the last 20 years, whatever. I mean, there's all these different stuff that you could point to and say, look, Israelis are in danger. And the way that we've reacted to this horrific 9/11 like tragedy has not actually made Israel much safer. The kind of opposite case, and one that I understand as compelling but also scares me, is, well, that's exactly right. We are doing right now what we've done every time before. And so we actually have to finish the job this time.
Right.
And that's the Israeli perspective. I mean, you know, we, as like Western Americans, I think we like love to talk about this conflict and view it from afar. But the reality is you go to Israel and you ask people, probably 80, 90% of them, that's the view.
Right.
It's not, we're worried about these half measures. It's like, yeah, the half measure is the thing we've done over and over again. And if we want to do something new, it's like take this war to its end. What scares me is when I ask people what they mean by that or what that actually looks like, there's a huge wide degree of responses, some of which, you know, include just like turning Gaza into a parking lot or going to direct war with Iran and just fighting that war now when it feels like maybe Israel has an advantage, which I think for a million different reasons terrifies me, because I don't know who it would invite, Russia, China, whatever. I don't know that Israel could definitely win the war. I think they probably would, especially with US backing. But, you know, it only takes one big bomb in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv for the contours of what's a success to really change.
I hear the pacifist and the Zionist meeting in conflict right now.
Yeah. And look, I don't, two things I'll say that maybe I should have said at the very top. I'm not a quote unquote expert. I consult a lot of experts. I have opinions and views about this stuff. And my pledge to readers and listeners is I'll share them honestly. And I have very, you know, specific views about it. But the view that I have that to me seems very obvious is like the more violence has never stopped the cycle of violence. It's also squishy to say, oh, it's an ideology and we have to kill the ideology. It's not that simple either. There has to be a show of force and you have to deter people and you have to respond and defend your civilians and all this stuff. And I get it. But I just don't think repeating some of the things that we've seen done, ground war in Lebanon, you know, operating in Gaza for an extended indefinite period of time and trying to install the leaders that we want there is going to actually meaningfully change the future from what we just lived through in the last 5 or 10 years.
What would you like to see happen?
I would
that
like
you
to
think would change the trajectory.
I would like to see Israel basically propagandize the Arabic world into understanding that the propaganda they're getting right now is not actually real. I mean, you look at how much money a country like Israel spends on, you know, media, news, PR, whatever you want to sort of bucket it in English compared to what it spends in Arabic.
Interesting.
And it's tenfold more. Mm. Why is that? We don't have to convince Republican senators in Oklahoma to send more money to Israel for arms. Mm-hmm. What we have to do is convince a 12-year-old who lives in Gaza not to go join Hamas. That's what we have to do. And right now, they're not getting contacted by Israel. Right. They're not hearing the Israel story. They're not hearing the Hebrew story. They're not hearing about a future of a two-state solution or a one-state solution where Palestinian citizens are living side by side with Israelis in whatever we want to call this great big land of Israel, depending on where you come from. Mm-hmm. They're not hearing that story. They're not hearing that vision. What they're getting is they see their cousins killed in a bombing. And then there's somebody there who has a gun and says, you want to stand up and fight and avenge your cousin or not? Mm. I don't want to patronize the Hamas side or the Arabic side and pretend that they're just like simple-minded children. That's not what it is. There's so much depth and history and thought and intellectualism behind their worldviews that we have to address and deal with. But like, Israel is not working to win those people over right now.
Right.
They aren't. I'm sorry. And like, and until they do, or until they attempt to, none of that's going to change. Look, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's going to take 2 years. It won't. It's going to take, we are generations away from peace.
It's a long road.
So, hate to break it to you, but like this war is not going to be over anytime soon. And we are generations away from resolving this conflict in a way that doesn't involve war. But the pacifist side of me is like, we've tried this part. We've tried the invasions, we've tried the bombings, we've tried beheading the extremist groups, we've done all that stuff, and it might work as a temporary fix, but it's not gonna get us to like the long-term vision that I think a lot of people want for the country and for the region as a whole.
All right, now to take a little turn, a little more lighthearted, we're gonna go to some questions from our social media audience that they've written in for you. SeanLev378 asks, who's your favorite Jewish comedian?
Favorite Jewish comedian? I mean, is it too like simple to say Adam Sandler?
That's who I would have said.
I'm like a, you know, I grew up when he was doing like Waterboy and stuff. And God, it's still, I go back, like you can turn me into a 12-year-old pretty quick by just throwing on like some really dumb Adam Sandler humor. He can still make me laugh.
And last one, Rach.Fleisch says, it's been a tough year. What's your favorite Jewish comfort food? And where do you get it in Philly?
My favorite Jewish comfort food is my grandmother's brisket, which I mentioned at the top. She's my late grandmother now, but the recipe lives on in the family. It's very simple. And whenever I really need to go there, I cook it. Though I will give a shout out to my mom's best friend, Susan, makes the best kugel I've ever had in my life.
What kind of kugel?
It's flavor? Like, you know, apple flavor.
Okay.
And it's so, I mean, like I look forward to the high holidays to go to her house and eat it. I was just there a couple of weeks ago. And that makes me, I eat that and I feel like I'm at home. It takes me back to my childhood. So that's one of them.
Isaac, thank you so much.
Thanks
for having
me. This
has been really enlightening. Really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for being so candid and open about everything.
I appreciate it, man. Great questions. Love you challenging me on stuff. That's the real spirit of what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to be here. Love the podcast. Love what you're doing with the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks again to my guest, Isaac Saul. If you haven't already sought it out during the episode, I highly recommend you subscribe to Tangle, which you can do at readtangle.com.
Thanks to everyone here in Philly for a fantastic visit. And of course, thanks to all of you for supporting the show. Please continue to share it with your friends. Make sure you are following us on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube. And whoever you're rooting for in this election, I hope your candidate wins. But not really. Bye.